on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Goodness gracious, the weekend is over. It is the end of thus far, this is the third straight, just amazing, beautiful, late spring, early summer days here in the hills and hollers of what used to be wild, wonderful West Virginia. We call it now almost level West Virginia. This is the home. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That, of course, is where you will find, first and foremost, a selection of news stories for any given day, assuming that I have been diligent in my duties and gone about the business of going out and selecting them for your perusal, which I did. There's a whole bunch of them out there for you to go and look at to your heart's content. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Just start scrolling and have a blast. We'll be probably talking about a few of those stories during the course of the next 3 hours. And also at the horn, you will find the pop-out player. And that is absolutely wonderful if you're listening to a PC. If you're on some sort of mobile device, however, I can highly recommend the players from TuneIn. And some of you like Stitcher. That's cool, too. Podcasting address, of course, is always at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program. Oh, what else? Yeah, of course, the chat room, free, easy, jump right in. Always a wonderful conversation going on in the chat room, no less so now. Folks wandering in even now. There's Jan and Jerry out in Vegas using the pop-up player now. It's coming through loud and clear, Bob Kincaid. Thank you, Jan. Thank you, Jerry. And Texas T has wandered into the room. So, too, has Anatole. Longtime indefatigable horn chat room moderator Sparky is on duty even as we speak out in what is probably a blistering hot Northern California. Oh, by the way, California is in the middle of a whooping cough epidemic. It was officially declared today. No word yet on whether or not Jenny McCarthy has yet been seen to scream about how whooping cough vaccinations turn your children gay, or was that Michelle Bachmann that said that? Anyway, that's in the stack, too. Finally, at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find the ever-present PayPal button. The PayPal button is how we keep up with keeping this all on the air. And I want to thank Brother Albert. Brother Albert helped out over the weekend to much effect. Brother Albert doubled his money thanks to the challenge that remains on the table, as posted by our good friend Darlene this past Friday. We pulled up short in fundraising Friday in a rather large way, but we'll get there. We'll get there, I hope. So there is $40 remaining in Darlene's challenge. That means the next $40 that comes in gets doubled. Your 10 becomes 20, your 5 becomes 10, your 20 can become 40. Up to the next 40 bucks that roll in for fundraising purposes. Thank you. Thank you very much, Darlene. And it is much needed because we've got our usual $150 fundraising goal, which is the evening's, any given evening's goal here. We have reached past the halfway mark in this month of June, and we are not quite at the halfway mark in fundraising. We finished about $100 short. Brother Albert took that down. The challenge remains to be met, however. Brother Albert took that down, and we're now about $90 short, so that puts us at $240 for the evening. But if Darlene's challenge finishes being met, and the fact that Dr. John has a challenge on the table to get the week started, well, then we can get a long way toward taking care of fundraising matters. Dr. John, as is his monthly wont, and much thanks to him for doing this, Dr. John started the whole matching challenge thing a while back, I do believe. But Dr. John is willing to match the first $50 that comes in. So that means your 10 becomes 20, 20, 40, 25, 50. Your 50 becomes 100, up to the first 50 that comes in. So we got 40 and then 50, which would mean that we had gotten to we'd gotten over the hump for fundraising for this evening, and a nice start on catching up on what didn't happen on Friday. Okie doke. So that's where it stands. I'll keep you posted throughout the evening as is usually the case, and as you have suggested, I do. Because remember, this is not a business. This is not a capitalist enterprise. This is an attempt to build community and keep all of this going, and hopefully keep not just maintain the dialogue, but expand the dialogue, maybe have a couple of laughs along the way. I don't know how much laughing is going to go on here in the next few minutes, really, because in point of fact, well, you know what day it is, right?
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
That's right, that's right. It's Moran Monday on the horn. Step right up, step right up. Get your programs here. This is the program that tells the Morans you just can't tell them much. Yes, indeedy, for less than 5 cents per minute, or 5 cents per hour of programming, by golly, you can have all the Morans your heart could possibly desire, and then go out and maybe check out why it is your heart desires Morans. Indeed, indeed. Behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas, you will hear Morans of all varieties, right-wing Morans, Republican Morans, teabagging Morans, libertarian Morans, John Birch Morans, open carry Morans, NRA Morans, gun-goobin' Morans, 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 Morans. Head for the hills or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. Oh, mercy, I'm not kidding. And by the way, a simple advisory, folks carrying bags or small children are advised to keep them close at hand when passing through the Moran Monday display. The Morans can get grabby. Some of them would like to grab your children and send them off to fight a brand new bloody spanking war in Iraq. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Moran Monday on the horn has begun. Step right up, our first display, our first creature here in the Moran Monday tent. Tony Blair. You betcha. Tony, hard not to say an entire string of vulgar, obscene epithets, Blair. Here, let's kill the Calliope music for a minute and find out, let us offer up the exhibit of why Mr. Blair, former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, former lapdog to George Bush, known in his native land as Bush's poodle. Let's find out why he gets top billing in this evening's Moran Monday exhibition, and I guess competition. I think, in keeping with tradition, I think we would do well on Moran Monday just to offer up a, you know, the difference between a watch and a warning in weather terms. I know our buddy Sergi in Texas does. You know, a warning means, oh my God, the fill in the blank has been spotted. It's coming. Take shelter, right? But a watch merely means that conditions are favorable for something awful to happen in the weather. Tornado watch, flash flood watch versus tornado warning, flash flood warning. Well, conditions are favorable for the viewing of morans, especially lately with the renewed call of all of these bloodthirsty, blood-sucking, blood-feasting, ain't even like a clock that's stopped insofar as they're not even right twice a day, neocon, p-nackin', Iraq war-loving asshats. And there was no more of an Iraq war-loving, bloodthirsty, blood-handed, yada, 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 than Tony Blair back in 2003. He has apparently not changed. So, yes, exhibit. Considered, submitted for your approval. Tony Blair took to the interweb tubes to write himself a essay. I'm gonna sit right down and write myself. No. Iraq, Syria, and the Middle East. An essay by Tony Blair. The civil war in Syria, with its attendant disintegration, is having its predictable and malign effect. Iraq is now in mortal danger. The whole of the Middle East is under threat. Should I just take this down maybe a notch and turn it into it? Because it's obvious that Tony wants badly to be seen as, because remember how the word was bandied about, lo, those 11 years ago, how the word Churchillian was bandied about, and the for-profit media fairly wet itself talking about how Churchillian Dim Leader was and how Churchillian Tony Blair was. Oh, sit, Tony, sit. Yeah, we should. We will have to rethink our strategy towards Syria, support the Iraqi government in beating back the insurgency, whilst making it clear that Iraq's politics will have to change for any resolution of the current crisis to be sustained. Then we need a comprehensive plan for the Middle East that correctly learns the lessons of the past decade. In so doing, we should listen to and work closely with our allies across the region, whose understanding of these issues is crucial and who are prepared to work with us in fighting the root causes of this extremism, which goes far beyond the crisis in Iraq or Syria. Sick of it yet? No, I'm not talking about the bad Churchill impression. I'm talking about the Tony Blair essay. It is inevitable that events in Mosul have led to a rerun of the arguments over the decision to remove Saddam Hussein in 2003. The key question, obviously, is what to do now. But because some of the commentary has gone immediately to claim that but for that decision, Iraq would not be facing this challenge, or even more extraordinary, implying that but for the decision the Middle East would be at peace right now, it is necessary that certain points are made forcefully before putting forward a solution to what is happening now. Sweet Jesus. And we haven't even gotten to the good part. Oh, no. Oh, if you... No, no, no. Don't think that you get to put away the tennis ball and the hockey pucks. Oh, no. No. No, I'm afraid we're going to be... rather busy, actually. Yes.
and welcome to Hurlingham Park. You join us just as the competitors are running out onto the field on this lovely winter's afternoon here with the going firm underfoot and very little sign of rain. Well, it certainly looks as though we're in for a splendid afternoon sport in this, the 127th Upper Class Twit of the Year show. Now, the competitors will be off any moment, so let me just identify them for you. Vivian Smith-Smythe-Smith has O-level in kennel hygiene. Simon Zinc Trumpet Harris, married to a very attractive table lamp. Nigel Incubator Jones, his best friend is a tree, and in his spare time he's a stockbroker. Gervaise Brooke Hamster is in the guards, and his father uses him as a waste paper basket. And finally, Oliver St. John Mollusk, Harrow and the guards, thought by many to be this year's outstanding twit. Now they're moving up to the starting line. There's a jolly good crowd here today. Are there understarters' orders? And they're off! Oh, no, they're not. No, they didn't realize they were supposed to start. Never mind, we'll soon sort that out. The judge is explaining it to them now. I think Nigel and Gervais have got the idea. All set to go. Oh, and they're off. And it's a fast start this year. All of us, Cindy Wallace, running a bit wide there. And now they're coming into their first test, the straight line. They've got to walk along this straight line without falling over. And Oliver's over at the back there. Simon's coming through quite fast on the outside, I think. Simon and Nigel, both of them coming through very fast. Oh, there's Nigel there, number three, I'm sorry. And on the outside, there's a face coming through just out of shelter now. The position, Simon and Vivian at the front coming into the matchbox jump. Three layers of matchboxes to clear. And Simon's over. And Vivian's over beautifully.
Oh. And we thought Monty Python were doing satire, parody, comedy. No, as usual, it turns out they were being prophetic. And by the way, yeah, like I said, come on by the Horn chat room. It's filling up. Good evening, Bean. Good evening, John CDN. Good evening, Stockton Larry. Come on by. If you've never tried, you just don't know how much fun you're missing. No, really. So back to Tony.
Three to four years ago, Al-Qaeda in Iraq was a beaten force. The country had massive challenges, but had a prospect, at least, of overcoming them. It did not pose a threat to its neighbors. Indeed, since the removal of Saddam, and despite the bloodshed, Iraq had contained its own instability, mostly within its own borders. Though the challenge of terrorism was and is very real, the sectarianism of the Maliki government snuffed out was a genuine opportunity to build a cohesive Iraq. This, combined with the failure to use oil money to rebuild the country and the inadequacy of the Iraqi forces, have led the alienation of the Sunni community and the inability of the Iraqi army to repulse the attack on Mosul and the earlier loss of Fallujah, which, by the way, is probably still toxic from the white phosphorus that we and the Americans use, not to mention the depleted uranium munitions residue that are redolent all over the Mesopotamian area, that land between the rivers. No, I'm sorry, I added that part. You start doing Churchill and you just get into this florid prose and you can't help yourself. Though the challenge of terrorism was and is very real, the sectarianism of the Maliki government snuffed out... Oh, wait a minute, did I... Wait, no. This combined with the failure... Oh, no, we were there. Fallujah. Yes, we were at Fallujah, weren't we? And there will be debate about whether the withdrawal of U.S. forces happened too soon. No, you upper-class twit... The debate will not be about whether U.S. forces withdrew too soon. The debate will be, or should be, whether we should ever have gone there in the first place. Especially in light of the fact that, Tony Blair, you're living in some sort of posh flat, posh digs, posh palace, posh country home.
when in fact you probably should be occupying a cot in The Hague. Having been first duly, ceremoniously, properly, and legally tried. Somebody help me. I got to get out of this damned accent. But it gets worse. The only thing Tony Blair can imagine is that we should have a debate on whether the U.S. left too soon. Well, he needs to have that debate with Dim Leader down there madly painting away. Has Dim Leader slashed an ear off yet? No, never mind. He's a painter now. He's not a politician. He's not an elder statesman. He's an artist. Oh, stop it. Having this guy in my head is worse than having the nasty preacher guy in my head on Wednesdays. No. It's going to get worse. As for how these events reflect on the original decision to remove Saddam, if we want to have this debate, we have to do something that's rarely done. Put the counterfactual. I suppose in 2003, Saddam had been left running Iraq. Now take each of the arguments against the decision in turn. Quite the pompous little ass, isn't he? Setting the rules for the debate that only he is allowing himself to participate in? Well, do let's play. The first is that there was no WMD risk from Saddam, and therefore the casus belli was wrong. What we now know from Syria is that Assad, without any detection from the West, was manufacturing chemical weapons. Oh, chase me down with a butterfly net. One of these days, I got to remember to go to the liquor store and get the tequila, and then maybe maybe the Dollar Tree Bush, don't say Bush, thingy place will have the swirly straws I desperately need. I mean, honest to God, as for how these events reflect on the original decision to remove Saddam, if we want to have this debate, we have to do something that is rarely done. Ay. We only discovered this when he used them. Not he, as in Saddam, using chemical weapons. No. Having taken leave of reason or an ability to hang on, having come unstuck in time all Billy Pilgrim-like, Tony Blair has gone flying off from 2003 into 2013, and suddenly Assad is Saddam. Luke, I am your father. We also know from the final weapons inspector's reports that though it is true that Saddam got rid of the physical weapons, he retained the expertise and capability to manufacture them. Yes, he in his little high mountain crag laboratory with the blinking light that says, evil scientist, boo, evil scientist, boo. Good God. Is it likely that, knowing what we now know about Assad, Saddam, who had used chemical weapons against both the Iranians in the 1980s war that resulted in over 1 million casualties, cleverly leaving out where Saddam got those chemical weapons that he didn't manufacture himself, but in fact purchased from the Ronald Reagan administration, and there was the accompanying photo opportunity involving Donald Rumsfeld shaking his hand while looking like a fox eating shit out of a wire brush. Yeah. Would it would have it refrained from returning to his old ways, surely it is at least as likely that he would have gone back to them. Like, kind of like Tony Blair wants to go back to his old ways.
We will fight the ISIS forces on the land, in the air, in the sea, even though it's a desert. We will fight them with other people's children. All I can promise you, parents of other people, is blood, sweat, toil, and tears. But not for me.
I love this. Maybe it's something that could be, it could go out on BBC Two or something. Arguing with myself, with Tony Blair. The second argument is that but for the invasion of 2003, Iraq would be a stable country today. Leave aside the treatment Saddam meted out to the majority of his people, whether Kurd, Shia, or Marsh Arabs. Really? Marsh Arabs? Tony, you old colonialist, you. Murphy, is it okay if I use Marsh Arabs in my essay instead of WOGs?
Yes, dear.
Whose position of stability was that of appalling repression. Consider the post-2011 Arab uprising. Put into the equation the counterfactual that Saddam and his two sons would be running Iraq in 2011 when the uprisings began. Is it seriously being said that the revolution sweeping the Arab world would have hit Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, Syria, to say nothing of the smaller upheavals all over the region, but miraculously Iraq, under the most brutal and tyrannical of all the regimes, would have been an oasis of calm? Oh, dear God, Tony, put down the dry sack. We have heard the bells at midnight. Jesus. So it is a bizarre reading of the cauldron that is the Middle East today to claim that but for the removal of Saddam, we would not have a crisis. And it is here that we want the right policy for the future. If we want that right policy for the future, we have to learn properly the lessons not just of Iraq in 2003, but of the Arab uprisings from 2001 onwards. You know, I think this rotten bastard's been watching. What are they? Looping Lawrence of Arabia over at the Blair place.
So long as the Arabs fight tribe against tribe, so long will they be a little people, a silly people, greedy, barbarous, and cruel.
Thy mother mated with a scorpion.
Yeah, I'm with Anthony Quinn there. Colonialism runs deep, doesn't it? That old urge to tell other people what to do, that old urge to go in and use other people's children to enforce those rules about what other people are supposed to do with the land that they live in and the colonialists don't. Hard to get over. You can just as easily imagine poor old Tony sitting around mumbling into his gin. You might talk of gin and beer when you courted safe out here and you sent to penny fights and all to shot it.
But if it comes to slaughter, you'll do your work on water, and you'll lick the blooming boots of him that's got it. 9 inches, sunny climb, where I used to spend my time a servant of Her Majesty the Queen. All them black-faced crew, the finest man I knew was our regimental bestie, Gunga Dean. It was Dean, you limping lump of brick dust, Gunga Dean. Ah, oh, slippy of the row, water, get it, panny low. You squidgy-nosed old idol, Gunga Dean. The uniform he wore was nothing much before and rather less than half of that behind. For a twisty piece of rag and a goat-skin water bag was all the field equipments he could find. When the sweating troop train lay in a sliding through the day where the heat would make your blooming eyebrows crawl, we shouted, Harry, boy, till our throats were bricky dry. Then we whopped him, cos he couldn't serve us all. It was Dean. You heathen, where the mischief have you been? You put some jewelry in it, or I'll marrow you this minute if you don't fill up my helmet, Gunga Dean. God, the wonders of empire die hard, even in 2014. And he's a long-winded bastard, too. He's got a lot of pauses. But sooner or later, he works his way down to trying to tell us all what to do. We have to unite with those in the Muslim world who agree with this analysis to fight the extremism. Parts of the Western media are missing a critical new element in the Middle East today. There are people, many of them, in the region, who now understand this is the battle and are prepared to wage it. We have to stand with them. Are those the same people, Tony, that were going to greet us as effing liberators, baby? The ones who were going to use the oil money to pay for the war in the first place so that, oh, the U.S. economy might not bleed and crash after we put, nearly a decade's worth of Iraq war on the credit card. Are those folks, Tony? What are their names? Repressive systems of government have played their part in the breeding of the extremism. A return to the past of the Middle East is neither right nor feasible. On the contrary, there has to be change. There will be. We have to shoot every one of them there. However, we have to have a more graduated approach, which tries to help change happen without the chaos.
Well, I'm sorry, Tony, but the chaos is already there, baby. They ain't getting around it. They're up to their necks, because many of them don't have heads anymore, in chaos. And, of course, feed into this the fact that the forces invading Iraq are doing everything in their power to they're putting out press releases as if they thought George W. Dimleader was still in charge. America, it's like something out of WWE. America, we will face you soon and we will feed the sand with your blood. Now, if we still had Dimleader and all, did you hear that? They said they're going to feed the sand with our blood. We got to do something about that. They tried to kill my daddy. Weapons of mass destruction. Yellow cake. Aluminum tubes. See, there's no mention of the yellow cake or the aluminum tubes or, my friends, these are real photographs of, yeah, no, that's none of the, not a, Downing Street memo doesn't appear anywhere in here. You remember the Downing Street memo? Where Tony and his pals, what was the phrase? Fixed the facts to fit the situation. Was that it? So back to Tony. You remember there are people, many of them in the region, who now understand this is the battle and are prepared to wage it. We have to stand with them.
Repressive systems of government have played their part in the breeding of the extremism.
We got to the...
On the contrary, there has to be change, and there will be.
Because he said so.
However, we have to have a more graduated approach.
Yeah, okay.
It tries to help change help happen without the chaos. We were naive about the Arab uprisings, which began in 2011. Evolution is preferable to revolution. I said this at the time, precisely because of what we learnt from Iraq and Afghanistan. I said that before in 2003. Evolution is is better than revolution. And George Bush looked at me and said, "Quit talking like a sissy. F Saddam, we're going to take him out."
And that first person plural, we. I can't figure out if he thinks he's the queen of bleeding England.
We.
Or if he's using, well, you know the old Lone Ranger joke, right? The one that has the punchline where his boon companion turns to him and says, "What do you mean, we, white man?" But he does sum up, after a great deal of maundering and platitudining and blathering.
The point is that we won't win the fight until we accept the nature of it.
I love that line. The point is that we won't win the fight until we accept the nature of it. What if the nature of the fight is that the only way to win it is not to fight in it? Well, now.
Iraq is a part of a much bigger picture. By all means, argue about the wisdom of earlier decisions, but it is the decisions now that will matter.
In other words, I am immediately and effectively and forevermore absolving myself of having effed the entire planet as best I possibly could, or worse, depending upon how one looks at things, and henceforward we will look forward and not back.
I got that from that American president fellow, Barack Obama. I think he's Irish. The choices are all pretty ugly. It is true.
You know what? There's absolutely nothing ugly about staying the hell out of it and minding our own business. Sure, it's ugly for the people there. It's been ugly for the people there. I mean, for a man who was educated in the... The rather serious English schooling system. What? Was he out playing cricket during history? I mean, that line.
The choices are all pretty ugly, but it's true. But for 3 years now, we've watched Syria descend into the abyss. And as it's going down, it is slowly but surely wrapping its cords around us, pulling us down with it. Bullshit. See also CAC. The only way we get pulled down with Iraq and Syria is if we go in and attach ourselves into those fights. Invigilate ourselves, as a matter. History is of no benefit to people who do not study it.
Shall we have a little conversation about why the Middle East is the mess that it is? Shall we have a little conversation about, say, the Balfour Declaration? Could we have a bit of chit-chat over a spot of tea about the partition of the Middle East in the ashes of the Ottoman Empire, in which entirely irrational, arbitrary, capricious national borders were drawn in a sit down between the French and the British. What say we have a little chat about putting the sons of Prince Faisal on the thrones of Transjordan and Iraq? Maybe we can have a little talk a little bit later about American involvement in and accession to the creation of the Royal House of Ibn Saud. Or that may be entirely too modern. We can talk about 2, 3, 4 centuries of the Ottoman Empire being referred to as the sick man of Europe. Weak and tottering, yet tolerated for the fact that it kept a lid on the eternal squabbling and skirmishing of largely nomadic, wandering, sectarian tribes who didn't like each other very much. Or we could talk about Parthia rising from the ashes of the old Persian Empire. Or we could talk about the Medes and the Persians. Or we could talk about Alexander and the little few years he spent going walkabout in the Hindu Kush. Yeah, there's lots to talk about there. But that's the key. I won't say fun, but it's damned interesting to talk about. It is a real booger when you decide that you are so colonially privileged that you need to go and sort it out. Two times. The United States has decided to meddle in a little bit of regime change in the Middle East. And like a pebble thrown into the center of a very deep, very broad pond, its ripples continue to propagate. We would not have the problems with Iran that we do, even though suddenly we've decided Iran are not the devil, and we're asking really nice, pretty please, with sugar on it, would Iran please use its powers for good in helping Iraq? No, we did that. Even though we created the chaos that has been Iran by deposing a democratically elected Prime Minister by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh. Yeah. I imagine Mossadegh and Jacobo Arbenz of Guatemala probably could have sat down and had a fascinating little conversation about what happens when fascism comes to town. Of course, carrying an American flag. Yeah, we meddled there. And, of course, then there's the meddling in Iraq, beginning with the first George Bush and the completely bogus claim about babies being abused in intensive care and hurled from windows and stuff that was just stolen straight up out of Shakespeare the way that Christopher Hedges stole straight up out of Hemingway. We could talk about that, and it's fascinating to talk about. Playing what if with history is more fun than playing Monopoly with a bunch of real Monopoly hardheads.
Iraq is part of a much bigger picture. By all means, argue about the wisdom of earlier decisions, but for the love of God, quit calling me Bush's poodle. And quit putting my face on those little fuzzy dogs that have been dyed pink and have those little pom-pom tails. Go away, Tony Blair. Just go. Go away. Stand not upon the order of your going. Go at once.
I remember your State of the Union address. Your call to duty. You called on our nation's best. You laid it out plain why our sons and daughters should fight. There was no question, it was all in black and white. Like so many, my son believed all of this. Without a shred of doubt, he marched off to enlist. Then came a memo from a place called Downing Street. How can this be true? What am I to believe? The flag-draped coffins that you don't want seen on TV. There's something that I'd like you to see. This is the pillow where he used to lay his head. Some old books him in bed. Here's a trophy from when he played Little League ball. Here's another day I spend staring at the wall. Keep a room of his things, but he's never coming back. Please tell me, why did my son die in Iraq? I need the truth from you, not from one of your paid hacks. Please tell me, why did my son die in Iraq?
It's the up-tempo nature of that song that sort of takes you by surprise. One of the most brilliant anthems to come out of the objections to George Bush's war against the people of Iraq from a from an album called It Can Never Happen Here. That's John Koontz, J-O-N-K-O-O-N-C-E. I suggest you might want to go out and try to find it and buy that song because it might come in handy. I got to thinking earlier today, because I do that. And I, frankly, I was, maybe this is sort of a post-Father's Day contemplation. Because we had a lovely Father's Day yesterday. Went over to the grandbabies and played with the three grandbabies, and we were all together and grilled hamburgers on the grill. That's where you do most of your grilling, on the grill, really. And just sat and talked and played in the sunshine and played with the dog and had a lovely time. And so in reading, when I got back, reading about Tony's little essay and reading it for the first time, and just SMFH. I did enough math on the fly to get me to the point where I realized that my son was 7 years old, or perhaps not quite 7 years old. Let's see. Not quite eight. He was seven. See how the math thing is with me? Not quite seven. Not quite eight. When George Bush started his war against the people of Iraq. Shock and awe. And all that silly flummery. Hateful, mendacious, blood-sodden. Yeah. Well, I sat through the war in Iraq, seeing the listings of mothers and fathers, sons and daughters, the listings of brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers who weren't coming back from Iraq, who had been lied right into their hallowed ground. And trying to at least engage in a little bit of empathy. I know the right wing and the Republican Party despise empathy, but trying just the same to engage in some. And not in the least being able to comprehend the amount of heartache, the amount of grief, the amount of anguish, and in some cases pure unmitigated fury and blind hatred that must have been and still be directed at George W. Bush and kind of sleazy Rice and Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld. You know, you go to war with the Secretary of Defense you have, not with the one you want. Dick Cheney, and Douglas Fife, and Tony Blair, and Colin Powell. And how one would ever begin to get past waking up every day and just hoping that the worst possible things in the world would happen to that vicious gang of killers and political mobsters. But now it's the 16th day of June 2014, my boy is 18, and the phone rings here. And it's the recruiters. And they want to talk about opportunities in the United States military. And it can be a siren song to which a young man might listen. Because one of the traditional outlets here in Appalachistan is more or less unavailable to my son. I don't think there's any circumstance in the world that would make him willing to go and sit, work on a mountaintop removal plot and know that he was poisoning his neighbors and his friends and children and our elders and people he had never seen and never would see and had never met and never would meet, but would know in his heart he had participated in their poisoning. That's out. Well, when that's out, the other thing that's left over here in Appalachistan is the poverty draft. And lots of young people in this state opt in for the poverty draft. Because what else? What else is there? Hint. Not a damned lot. Not much at all. Walmart. Heard a story. Somebody talking about maybe on Friday's program that Walmart is going green and they're going to put solar panels on all of their stores and start powering the stores with solar power. And dear God, if I was just a little more subversive, I'd find a way to make sure that the friends of Cole found out about that and watch them get hopping up and down mad. But if you have a child of military age, and we've got, counting my son-in-law, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It can never rest easy when you see things like my Senator Joe Manchin showing up on Hardball with Chris Matthews, on Thursday? Saying, well, I'm open to all alternatives. I'm open to bombing Iraq. Did I ever tell you that Joe Manchin managed to miss out on Vietnam? Yeah, he was a student up at West Virginia University, my alma mater, Harvard on the Mon. And he just couldn't go and fight the Viet Cong or the NVA because Joe had football knee. No, really. Now, he didn't have 5 deferments like Dick Cheney. It only took 1 for Joe. He had football knee. And so it's a little ashen in the mouth when you hear him say, I'm opening to bomb Iraq. Yeah? You gonna fly it, Joe? And shut the up. Because I've had it. I have straight up had it. I don't want to hear anybody in politics, and God knows, over the weekend, everybody who was wrong in 2003 got to come back on the Sunday news programs and be wrong some more. Maxine Waters got it right in 2003. Was she invited on to Meet the Prestitutes this week? No. Ambassador Joe Stevens was right in 2003. Did he get it? No. How about Dennis Kucinich? Sorry. But if you were wrong about Iraq in the first place, by God, the for-profit media were more than ready for you. They just about had to get the smelling salts out for Aunt Pity Pat Lindsey Graham when he started telling people, the seeds of another 9/11 have already been sown. They're being sown. Goodness gracious, I'll worry about it tomorrow. Then again, speaking of seeds, there is a seed, a kernel, a germ of truth in what he says, because the seeds of the next 9/11 were sown. And they were sown by George W. Bush in 2003. They were sown in photographs of the reality that is a 50-year-old man carrying his 2-year-old granddaughter out of a heap of rubble as her body hangs limp and lifeless in his arms. And lest anybody think I'm stereotyping, I'm not going to sit here and say because the memory for vengeance in those Arab people is strong. No. The urge to vengeance is strong in all of humanity. And who can blame them if they remember who was responsible for sending a Tomahawk missile into their hut, their home, made of the same dry bricks that people from that region have been making homes out of for just about as long as we have been sedentarily human? Who can blame them? Not I. Not I. The opposition is building. Democracy for America, and of course there's a donate button at the bottom. There's always a donate button at the bottom. Democracy for America via Charles Chamberlain just wrote saying, Bob. Yes, Charles? Once again, the headlines are full of awful stories coming out of Iraq, and Republican hawks like Senator Lindsey Graham are warning that we must bomb Iraq to avoid the next 9/11. Which is like saying we need to chop off someone's head to avoid the next beheading. I added that, not Charles Chamberlain. He's not responsible for it. Of course, these are the same people who recklessly led us into a decade-long quagmire in Iraq. This current catastrophe would not be unraveling if President George W. Bush had not chosen to invade this divided country in 2003 on trumped-up intelligence. I think at this point in time, 11 years later, calling it intelligence is probably gilding the lily. Yeah. At Democracy for America, we knew that invading and destabilizing Iraq was a huge mistake. Yep. DFA members worked for years to end the war. Yep. We fought to elect President Obama because he promised to end the occupation of Iraq and bring our own troops home. Yep. That agreement, of course, was signed by George W. Bush in 2008. Yet, of course, that one in our White House is taking... big old weak-willed anti-colonialist, that one, Kenyan Muslim in our White House. Please join us today in speaking out against the bombing of Iraq. Thank you. Consider it done, Charles. Consider it done. The bombing of Iraq, the attack on the people of Iraq, grieved my father mightily. I remember when he looked at the little fascist in the White House, and he said, this is not what we fought for in the Second World War. He said, this is not what my brother fought for and came home in a box over. This, my father said, what word did he use? I think he said this makes those sacrifices obscene. obscene. And obscene they are. It's 5 minutes past the hour of 7 p.m. here in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone. Your conversational input is more than welcome. This is, after all, conversation radio. Your support in help keeping this whole thing running is also much appreciated. We are an hour and 6 minutes into the program, and at this point in time, with $90 of matching challenges on the table, not a penny has been taken in the way of matching it. You might recall Darlene started us off with a $100 challenge on Friday night in the hope of getting all caught up. We didn't get all caught up. And so we are around the $240 mark as far as what we need to fundraise this evening. And $90 worth of matching challenges would go a long way. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. So too is the traditional mail address. Let's do take a break. A reminder, if you want to call into the program, we're still working out the details on getting the Comrex fixed. So the six lines that we usually have are not available to us. But we do have a phone line open, 304-574-8178, 304-574-8178. And on Skype, simply Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid Horn. Either way is fine. I think I'll stick with the theme here. We'll be back.
What can you see from your window? I can't see anything from mine. Flags on the side of the highway and scripture on grocery store signs. Maybe 18 was too early, maybe 30 or 40 is too. You get your chance to make peace with the man, or is something on his angel. Silent old men
did they say when they shipped you away to fight somebody's Hollywood war?
Jason Isbell, with another profound manifestation of the horrible stupidity of the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War. That is Dress Blues. Wow, thanks to Beth and to Asa. We are off and running. On fundraising for this evening, Beth getting us started, and Asa coming in just almost immediately thereafter, so that we have completed, Darlene's $100 challenge. That's a big deal. And Dr. John's $50 challenge is on the table, and $5 completed. So that means $45 more to complete Dr. John's challenge, which will get us up to about $60 away from completely out of the hole. Having a little conversation with John Fox at the moment too, so let's go do the conversation radio part of this process. If you want to jump in and stand with Asa and Beth, it would certainly be appreciated. I do believe we have Bill here. Hey, Bill.
Hey, good evening. How are you?
Pretty good. Yeah.
It's been a funny day. So, what's going on with your end of the world? What's got you more? What's got you thinking more than anything else in the world, bro?
Well, the last hour would kind of indicate that I'm a bit obsessed with this whole let's go back and screw up in Iraq some more business.
I couldn't catch that. What?
Iraq.
Oh, again, yes. Are we on a treadmill, or is it my hallucinating the whole thing?
No, we've been here before.
There's so much to this. I don't know. I haven't heard too much today from anything that in our own government that's, bothering me too much. But it's the other people, the people who just don't get it, the people who just don't understand the whole thing. But I think a lot of this thought this might happen to begin with.
Well, yeah, that this would be the ultimate outcome of invading Iraq? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. It's totally useless. And the timing of it, I still can't figure out what swung these guys out of Syria. What fired them up? What do you think got them going?
Well, for starters, they're being funded by Saudi Arabia. These things don't just happen in a vacuum.
Thank you. Our buddies, Saudi Arabians.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had that feeling for a long time.
It's just an ugly little hegemonic game that we taught them to play, and well, they play it pretty well.
I don't know why. Saudi Arabia. Down to Malaysia, kill me. Why they ever got their start the way they did, Bob? What commissioned them in the 1900s to, complete autonomy from the rest of the world?
Oh well, they had all been that entire region had been provincialized by the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah,
and then the Ottoman Empire in a sublime fit of not particular brightness, decided that they wanted into the Great War. That's a bit of an oversimplification, but it's close enough.
Yeah. I mean, Saudi Arabia after the war, now I know that the Saudis supposedly stood alongside Lawrence. Is that the whole deal there?
No. The people that Lawrence was working with were the Hashemites, which was Prince Faisal and all, and that's how they wind up on the throne of Transjordan and, oddly enough, Iraq.
Okay, yeah. Because how these guys, with the small power they actually attain, I mean, the big power is the money, okay? What?
Yeah.
But you can only do so much with money.
Oh, it does a lot. It does a lot, Bill.
Weaponry and the ability to swing the rest of the people behind you.
We threw a lot of money at Iraq, and you're absolutely right. It didn't buy us much of anything. And here's the fun part. The opposition that's sweeping through Iraq now are largely armed with our guns.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
The guns that we left for the Iraqi army that the Iraqi army threw down, ripped their uniforms off, and ran.
Yep. Now, why would you say that they're throwing their uniforms down and running? Is it just no belief in the system?
It's super...
Well, they would rather be ruled by the Saudis?
Well, the Saudis aren't doing it openly, Bill. That's all just quiet money.
Yeah.
But when you see these people descending upon you and everyone falling in front of them, and you see what they're doing to the people who kept the uniform on.
Yeah, true.
Run, because that's in the nature of a rout, Bill. I mean, you know this. You're historically. Astute. When the rout starts, stopping the rout is just about impossible.
Now, what do you think is going to happen with Iran at this point? They are putting some people in already themselves, are they not?
Say again, please.
Iran. What, do you think they're going to stand still for this?
Oh, no. Iran is already consulting with the Iraqi Maliki government because it's a... See, and here's the problem.
Yes.
Iraq is, and this is, for most people, most people think, for instance, that the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite and a Sufi, maybe, is like the difference between a Lutheran and a Presbyterian and a Baptist.
Much deeper than that.
Deeper, bloodier, more hate-filled. Yeah, it's a lot more like the difference between a Protestant and a Catholic in, say, 1500.
Yep.
Kill or be killed.
In the reason so many of the people from the Irish
Northern Ireland is another good example, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you guys go down there and take care of these people, yes. Because the whole Iraqi idea was, I'm trying to think of what it was called. Was it Mesopotamia? Was that what they called it in the...
Oh, that's the Greek. The Greeks, a long, long, long time ago, when the Alexander and his buddies were marching through there, they were calling it Mesopotamia because meso means middle, and potoi, I think, is the word, means river. So Mesopotamia would be the land between the rivers. You know, Tigris here, Euphrates here, Mesopotamia.
Yeah. That was the name for that back in those days. Just to describe the what the two rivers were able to provide. back in the glory days of the whole situation, back prior to, you know, way before JC, you know.
Oh, well, and many of these problems extend back before Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi. I know that's.
I'm not mistaken, Bob. I've seen references in World War I history to Mesopotamia.
Well, sure, because there were because World War I encompassed Mesopotamia in part.
Yeah, yeah. Because the rest of all these little emirates have sprung up all over the place. Kuwait, for instance. Where the hell did they all come from? Whose brainchild was that? Was that wonderful England again?
I don't know that part. I mostly just know that Lebanon and Syria were given to the French. Palestine was given to the British. Iraq, Transjordan, you know, British protectorates, of course. And of course, the British had an intimate relationship with Persia/Iran.
Yeah, the Foreign Legion and the English had some prolific bloodletting in Syria during World War II. The Foreign Legion fought for Vichy, you know, in Syria, because there were some movements. And then there was a war between Iraq and England that went about 10 years. It was an off and on again. Being after World War One, and then when the Depression came along, the English kind of kicked back and got out of it a little bit because they couldn't afford it anymore. They had wasted enough money that they didn't have already. It's enough to make me want to think that this is a bottomless pit. This whole situation is a bottomless pit. And my first wife and I used to discuss putting Israel into its original place. And we kind of, our way of joking about it was, well, maybe we should have, the UN should have put Israel in Miami Beach. Because at that time, it was very heavily American Jewish neighborhood, you know, American Jewish area at that point in time. Because there was they recommissioned the ancient biblical state of Israel, and right in the laps of people who were already chaotic and who didn't like them very much. It's like going out of your way to start problems, to create a situation. And then, of course, you throw the oil into it, which is the money angle of the whole thing. It's like, you have any ideas how the hell we stop this stuff? Not we, but them, or everybody, or anybody?
First of all, Bill, I think we have to disabuse ourselves of the hubris that says we know how to fix something because we're wonderful us.
You got it.
One, and what I'm suggesting is that there are stages of that learning. The first learning we have to really, really take in deep is that democracy cannot be imposed at the muzzle of a gun.
Amen.
Secondly, and I know this is deemed to be heretical, but democracy doesn't always mean what we define it to be, because we are certainly not practicing the democracy the way it was invented. Democracy, democracia, if I've got the Greek right, is rule by the people, but the people are defined in the original version of democracy as being male landowning property class.
Yeah. I was just some quote from a Civil War thing where Braxton Bragg was complaining about the Southern Army. The problem they had was too much voting rights, basically. too much freedom of voting was a problem with his army out west, and he couldn't control it. Interesting. So they don't really want anybody to say anything.
But back up just a second, because the whole notion. Let's talk about this democracy thing a little bit, Bill. Because we're not practicing it the way the Greeks did it, and if you look at democracy in the broader scope of governments that have worked and governments that haven't worked and governments that have lasted and governments that haven't lasted, you can make a credible argument that democracy is among the least successful forms of government ever to exist on planet Earth. Unless you take into account the governing practices of the peoples of the Western Hemisphere prior to and even after 1492. And I know this is going to sound crazy, but there's more democracy taking place in the tribes of indigenous people in this country than there is in any American governmental unit.
Well, one thing I heard last night, I was listening to a station out of San Francisco, KGO.
Yeah.
There was a report that came through their news department that two Russian bombers were off the west coast of the United States. Is anybody else in the world hear that, or was that crazy or what? Or was it
what, aircraft? There's
yeah.
Was fired
off the west coast in American territory.
In American airspace.
That's what. See, they never went that far. Just off the west coast. And my first response was, well, were they within American airspace? Because I think if they had been within American airspace, they would have had some company up there. Or at least I hope they would have. I think if we had done
I'm gonna put a question to the Horn chat room and the Horn family commune congregation.
Yeah, please, honest.
Is KGO still nominally progressive?
No. I'll say that.
Okay, so that immediately causes...
Sunday night they have a female correspondent who is fairly progressive, and then they have Corral, if you know Corral is.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of shocked when I heard that, because I heard it once, and they never repeated the story. Because those aren't the kind of things you throw out over the air.
Well, see, when it comes from a station of marginal provenance, and frankly, any Clear Channel owned or massive, they inspire no confidence in no trustworthiness in me. Then my inclination is to ask him who reported this to him. Sarah Palin? Did she see him from Alaska?
Exactly. They didn't go that far. They talked about this. The woman's name is Pat Thurston, and you can Google her up, and she's fairly progressive in her outlook. And well, progressive means she doesn't believe in the pillories anymore. You know, I guess that's progressive, huh? Or the ducking stool, or you know, that kind of courtroom case.
Oh, you mean she believes in giving them a fair trial before hanging them? And that makes her...
She leans pretty hard the other way about not going to get involved in anything over there. That's, that's where she... But she didn't report the story. It was reported by their news department. And it's like, why are you running stuff like that? You can't back it up with anything, but you're throwing stuff out that's kind of off the wall. What would the Russians be doing over there? I don't look at Putin as an enemy to this country at this point in time.
No, he just, he's got, look, it's that H word.
He's got his own trouble.
No, he's got the hegemony blues. He's suffering from the same sickness that has tormented European headmen, European big men, for as long as there have been European nation states. Today, Russia cut off Ukraine's gas.
Yeah. And my thing about the whole Ukrainian idea is that some Western capitalist businessmen, they want to grab that. There's something in it for them that they really want to get their hands on.
Well, that's not even speculation anymore. They know that there's frackable gas under Ukraine.
Yeah.
And Joe Biden's already been over there hollering, frack, baby, frack. And now Joe Biden's son is sitting on the Ukrainian gas company's board of directors.
Man, is he a disappointment. Biden, if you go back, you know, the early parts of his career, he's been sitting on the edge of the, he's been sitting on that piece of cardboard going down the hill for quite a while.
Let me run something past you, Bill, because I was reading some of this Ukraine stuff earlier today, and I engage in a little bit of speculative problem solving, just because, well, I'm a hillbilly.
Well, when you hear about
I'm a hillbilly elitist, and I get to do that. So consider this: Russia has cut off Ukraine's gas. They've warned Western Europe that there may be an interruption in gas supplies. You, given your fascination with history, Bill, I'm sure you're familiar with something called the Berlin Airlift.
Yep.
I'm sure you're equally familiar with something called the Marshall Plan.
Yep.
And we know for a fact that the EU is far more serious about climate change than we could be if we were twice as serious as we are now, correct?
Yes. They have taken much more action over there in the field of electronic power distribution, et cetera.
Well, what if, just humor me, what if we somehow found buried out in the desert somewhere our long-lost American can-do attitude? What if we looked at the EU and said, "You really want to tweak Pooty Poot's nose? Let's have ourselves a green Marshall Plan. Let's get all the great minds." And I'm thinking from a World War II mindset, because I was thinking about my dad yesterday, and you know how that works. Let's get the great minds of solar and wind and geothermal energy together, and let us make Ukraine an absolute jewel of renewable energy. Let's make them so renewable that they're exporting their renewable green energy. Let's put solar panels on everything that's got a roof. Let's put wind turbines everywhere. Screw the fracking, screw the drilling, and screw the Russian gas. We know the technology works. We know it can be done. Let's do it. What's Russia going to do? Bomb the wind turbines?
Yeah. You're telling me something that I have thought of 40 years ago, that the price of power deliverance would be as high as they can get away with giving it to us, as long as they want to. They have the control. They're controlling life and death is what they control. It's kind of cold where you are in the wintertime, isn't it?
It does get that way, yes.
Yeah. And if they can't deliver,
it got hatefully so, yes.
Well, a friend of mine was involved in selling some land for fracking down around down on the big arsenal in the Warren, Youngstown, that area down there where the I can't remember the name of one of the biggest arsenals. I hope one of your folks and send the name of the place. It's been down there forever. Her backyard goes up against the fence for that. So they came in, they paid her some money. And then a few weeks ago, they tried to literally back out on what they owed her. They gave her half the money, and then they said, oh, well, we don't want to give you any more because for some reason they said there wasn't anything there. After cutting a deal to pay so much for it to begin with, now they want to change the terms of the contract. It's, you know, it's like buying or selling a car and then raising the price. These guys, since they didn't find anything, they want to cut the amount of money they're going to give people. I mean, talk about a guy in a corner with a pistol and a highway robbery. What do you call that?
A mugging.
So this is now becoming an international situation. It can be grand theft on the international scale. And Putin, of course, is... But I always talk about how much wheat. Somebody conjure up how much wheat the Ukrainians are still producing.
They're a huge exporter of grain.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons that the British, the Germans went after the Turks. If the Turks could close the exit from the Black Sea, the Dardanelles, whatever you want to call those, that straits or whatever, Gallipoli area, that's why the Turks got into the war on the side of the Germans, and then the British went after Gallipoli, and oh my God, you know?
Yeah.
Because that stuff looms harder to you and in our minds, you and me. We think so much of what you need, it's the 100th anniversary of that mess. And it's still continuing, so I'd agree with you.
Yeah, it's reverberating down through history. Yeah. That's the way history works.
Yep. It's like, I'm so damn old, I just gotta finally dig myself a nice deep hole and crawl into it, you know?
I don't know. Stick around, Bill. The fireworks could be spectacular.
Well, I gotta stick around since I just put in a small order to Binkers today.
Oh my God. Two orders in 2 weeks? Yeah.
Well, I've opened up the secret Teutonic addiction.
Yes, you are. You are powerless over Verstin, and your world has become unmanageable. I understand.
Yeah. Believe me, sometimes I feel that way. Because today I tried to get some shopping done, and my number one driver, my piano player from 30 years of working with me, they got a couple of jobs this week. And he doesn't really care for it either, except that it helps out the retirement fund, you know. Because we all feel that way. If you're John D. Rockefeller, that wasn't enough money. It had to go for more, you know. Theoretically, that's
you know, but if you're from that class, the word enough does not exist in your vocabulary.
Yeah. And that seems to have become a national health problem in this country. This trying to survive deal. That's what's hurting us so bad. What I need is the opinion of you and a bunch of other people as to what the hell is going to happen here. You can't let this run wild, because eventually it's going to involve the state of Israel.
And of course, everything is bent towards keeping them out of it, and the Palestinians are keeping them busy, and they're keeping the Palestinians busy. Some Israelis got kidnapped, so in retaliation, Israel attacked a bunch of homes, arrested a bunch of former diplomats and former government people, and murdered a 19-year-old. So, well, they're busy.
Yes. And there were some kidnappings of some Israelis in the last over the last week in our first reports of that. So after a while, you begin to wonder, did I actually hear this news report? Or maybe I'm finally crossing the line and better revert to a, is that a good comic book? You know, anything. It's impossible.
Three letters. G.
I mean, what's your opinion as to how this is going to play out?
Three letters. G-I-N. Gin. And I ain't talking about rummy.
No.
It might get you through. How's it going to play out?
I don't have anything good. All I have is some of that cheap drugstore gin that one of my health aides bought, thinking it was... That stuff isn't even usable as hair talk. Are you kidding me? Get out of here.
Hey.
That's
a joke, of course, Bill, but how's it going to play out?
Yeah. I mean, these people listen to, like you and so many other people with big brains, say, what the hell's going on? What the hell?
Well, all we can say is, see, we told you this was going to happen, and it's not just us. You know, remember, when he started the first Bush War, George H.W. Bush refused to drive on to Baghdad because people like Brent Scowcroft and everybody associated with George H.W. said, listen, if you take out Saddam, you're going to destabilize the region, and it's just going to be a mess. And George said, makes sense to me, so I'm not going to do it. So a decade later, you get his son in there, and he's got deep psychological and psychiatric issues relating to daddy that have things to do with, being left with the nanny the day that his baby sister died while they went out and played golf the day they buried her. And
so we're reverting to extreme personal psychosis.
I think that plays a role.
Jesus.
But the thing is, we knew in 2003, we knew in 2002, 2001, that this was going to be the outcome. Because, among other things, the bodies of some 55,000 young Americans had told us what the outcome was going to be in Vietnam. And even though the idiots and the right-wing PNACers and neocons all squealed about how, well, this is Iraq, this is not Vietnam, it's no fair, you quit calling it Vietnam, this is Iraq, it's not Vietnam, we're not going to have a quagmire, we're going to win. We're going to be greeted as liberators.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. But it is. You were a much younger man when Vietnam fell to the north. When South Vietnam fell to North Vietnam. Did anybody not see that coming, Bill?
I own two or three books on the French War in Indochina, which to me already painted a picture. And if I talk about the. What the hell did they call it? The massive air bombing around Dien Bien Phu. There was a name for it. They had chosen a name, and they were talking atomic weapons to do it. And it was the Dulles brothers who were primarily shooting their mouth. Operation Vulture was the name of it. To stop the Viet Minh from going any farther, to destroy the Viet Minh on the ground, destroy their main battle force with massive raid, and they were talking nukes at one time. So that's how insane things were. That was 54.
I was a child.
Do
you remember, Bill, do you remember how Vietnam got started? You know, we're just going to have a few military advisors on the ground, yada, yada, yada. Okay, so I've got some news for you posted this evening as of 6:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time over at Politico, which is of marginal veracity. President Barack Obama has notified Congress that up to about 275 U.S. military personnel are headed to Iraq to help the State Department relocate some staff from the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad to the U.S. Consulate General in Basra and Erbil and to the Iraq Support Unit in Amman. In a letter to Congress, Obama wrote that the force is deploying for the purpose of protecting U.S. citizens and property if necessary and is equipped for combat. This force will remain in Iraq until the security situation becomes such that it is no longer needed. Implicit in that bill is the statement, or they are all dead.
Yeah. Well, Anyway, but I'm going to cut out of here, but I wanted to change the subject quick to the death of one man over the weekend. A man who played football for the Cleveland Browns when I met him. And he was a linebacker, and he left the game in 55 injured. And a buddy of mine's uncle took the linebacking job from him. And later this guy came back as an offensive guard. And he was a guard who carried plays in and out. Because Brown used to use the messenger system. Two offensive guards alternated taking in plays. And this guy became a coach for the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Chuck Knoll.
And he went to the same high school I went to, in fact.
Chuck Knoll passed away over the weekend?
Yes.
I'll be darned. I had no idea. Thank you for telling me.
Well, we had a big department store, Sterling Linda Davis, that had a huge Christmas tree, and they'd always have special visitors over the holidays, and me and two of my buddies walked down there to talk to Chuck, and interesting man, very interesting man, but he was can you imagine you're playing ball for Paul Brown, and you're carrying plays in, and offensive plays. And you're working with the guy who, at his point in time, Paul Brown was the ruling force in professional football in the 50s. I mean, basically, when your team keeps winning the division title year after year for, 6 years or so in a row, you're doing something right, you know? And Chuck was the man carrying the plays in. So somewhere along the line, he became one hell of a head coach, didn't he?
He was studying at the feet of a master, for starters.
Yeah, at that point in time, yes. I mean, there's a coaches come and go. There's always good, great ones in the league. But Paul, at this point in time, was like Jesus Christ himself. I mean, most people don't know anything about the All-America Football Conference. And that's where the 49ers came from and the Browns came from to join the NHL. And a team from Texas that folded flat on its face and moved to Baltimore, Maryland. And became the Colts, which is why, if anybody ever wondered why Baltimore was in the Western Division of the National Football League in those days. I kept wondering about my sense of geography. What's wrong with you, Bill? Baltimore, Western Conference? Oh, okay. So they just had to stick a body in there, you know? But Chuck was, people hated him here. Me, all I can say is the guy learned from somebody and sure put it to work. What did he go, 1-13 his first year?
But the Steelers had a history of being abysmal long before Chuck Knoll ever became the head coach.
They were terrible. The story behind it was that the original owner, Art the First, not Modell.
No, Mr. Rooney.
Art Rooney. Yeah, he liked to play cards and gamble. And you looked at some of the coaches he hired. And in fact, things were so bad during the World War II that there was a team called the Steagles. It was a merger of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia during the Second War.
I'll be darned, I never knew. Oh, hey, I've got an answer. I've got an answer to your question, Bill. The first one you posed, this coming in from Isaac. According to CNN, U.S. fighter jets intercepted Russian bombers off Alaska and California this month, and because they entered the 200-mile air defense identification zone, the Pentagon went on to note that the Russian planes were entirely within their rights during the flight. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren said they followed all the protocols. It was a very professional encounter on both sides. There was nothing that they were doing that was contrary to international law. They were intercepted by a pair of F-22 fighter jets in Alaska, and the ones that turned and at that point, two of them turned and went west, and two turned and went south, at which point they were intercepted off the California coast by a pair of F-15 fighter jets. They never entered U.S. territory proper. That's defined by international law as 13.8 miles from the coastal United States.
So they were close, but no cigar.
Yeah, there was no drama whatsoever. If it was reported as being dramatic, it wasn't.
Well, they just reported the fact and never covered it any farther than that. It's just like the steel beam was, what do they call it in the hook in the cartoons, the sky hook?
Yeah.
So you hear that part of it, and me having a mind that still cranks pretty good, really beat up as it's been, I said, what the hell are they doing there? What the hell is that about? And of course, you try to fit it into what's going on in the Middle East. Were the Russians saying something to us that we should stay the hell out of the whole thing?
According to the CNN story, it's just de rigueur. It happens. It's absolutely not unique. It is not unheard of. It's not even unusual. I got a note from Jim a few minutes ago saying, tangential Russian overflights happen frequently, as do ours over Russian airspace.
That's what I would think, that we would have the same thing going on, but you never hear. I mean, I'm just shocked the way they do this as a half-assed news story. Like, what the hell is going on here, folks? Get that stuff right. That's important stuff. I try to recommend things to people. Did you ever see the movie or read the book, The Sand Pebbles?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm familiar with the Steve McQueen movie.
Where those gunboats sailing up and down Chinese waters.
Right.
And then the Japanese sunk one in the 30s at Panay, which was an international incident. It's like, oh, my God. How do we keep going when... we got people like you. You got minor problems, Bob. You've got kids to feed and all kind of minor stuff like that, you know?
In the grand scope of the great political hegemonic games, that whole feeding families thing is just insignificant. Right, Bill?
Well, Barbara Tuchman hit it with the guns of August. She was right on the money. And she did a thing called Stillwell and the American Experience in China, which gave you a good look.
I love both books, Bill, but my favorite of hers is A Distant Mirror.
Oh, yeah. Is that really what, 14th century?
Actually, A Distant Mirror, followed by The Proud Tower, followed by The Guns of August, followed by Stillwell, followed by Bible and Sword. That's my listing of favorite Barbara Tuchman books.
Yeah, she was so much on the money with so much that when you look at World War One, the King of England, the Tsar of Russia, and the Kaiser of Germany, what did they have in common, Bob?
They were kinfolks.
Yeah, they were all cousins. Yes.
Who were willing to use poor people and workers to settle their own nasty little internecine rivalries.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I just don't know if Obama thinks that we should go back into this Iraq thing. He's not even the first. Or the truth of the matter is that maybe since Truman's time and Ike and Kennedy, we don't know what his plans were for Vietnam. Because somebody took him out.
Actually, we do kind of know what his plans were for Vietnam, because the speech that he was going to deliver and did not get to, did it not contain a reference to getting the hell out of Vietnam?
Yep.
It was in his jacket pocket, was it not?
Yeah. Which could have been the reason why he ceased existing. But, of course, everybody, these newspaper people, all we hear about is a man's outside relationships. And there were so many reasons. Didn't his brother, the attorney general, from what I had heard, some mob money was spent during the West Virginia primary? Am I being paranoid?
I don't know that it was mob money, but I do remember a joke being told that old man Joe said, be careful how much money he spent, that he didn't mind buying an election, but he didn't want to pay too high a price or something like that.
That's possible.
But understand, it's not like the Kennedys invented that in southern West Virginia. If we ever get down to the point where there are only two eligible to vote human beings left in Logan County or Mingo County or McDowell County, West Virginia, you know what's going to happen? They're going to sell their votes to each other and buy their votes from each other on Election Day. It's just how it is.
And it's happened so much. I mean, there's been so much truth told about the ballot box.
We've got people in West Virginia of whom it is said that when they died they had to be screwed into the dirt because they were too crooked to bury laying down.
I haven't heard that joke in 40 years, but it's still right. It's still effective. I heard that a long time ago and I laughed then, and it's like, what's wrong with me that I laugh at stuff like that?
Oh, I think you're supposed to. Hey Bill, it's been good talking to you. I'm good.
Hey, you hang in there. I hope there's some other folks with some opinions, because these people have me at a stone wall right now. It's a stone wall where I'm tired of running my head against for a lifetime, you know?
Yeah, it begins to leave a mark.
You hang in.
It begins to leave a mark after a while, Bill.
Well, the only thing I can say, it feels so good when you stop.
Well, there you go. Later.
Take care.
Bye now. Our buddy Bill, calling from Cleveland, Mr. Stress. One and only. Note coming in from Robert in Australia. Part of the coalition forces to invade Iraq in 2003 consisted of 2,000 Australians. We also sent a few ships and planes. No Australian military personnel were killed during any military operations. 3 died as the result of accidents. All received full military honors and an honor guard when their bodies were returned to Australia. Yeah, I'll bet they didn't hide their return home from the media, did they? Of course, I remember. Do you? I remember during Georgia's war against the people of Iraq. I remember when the story broke that our soldiers were being sent home in cardboard boxes. You remember that? I do. Robert continues. 6 Australians working as private security contractors have been killed. All Australian troops have been withdrawn by July 2009. The cost to Australian taxpayers has been around $5 billion to date. Many Australians protested us getting involved in the war from the start. These protests were mostly ignored by mainstream media, owned by guess who. I never knew Rupert Murdoch was a member of the guess who. Sorry. As best I can find out, Prime Minister John Howard agreed to join the coalition forces in return for access to the USA beef lamb market. It's a hell of a trade. What was that in 2003? We called that the Coalition of the Billing, didn't? Oh no! That was the Coalition of the Willing. That's where Morocco sent bomb-sniffing monkeys. Not that I'm taking anything away from Morocco. I do have a little bit more respect for monkeys than to ask them to sniff for bombs. I mean, they are, after all, cousins. Oh, Jesus, don't tell the Baptists. Robert italicizes the following. And while arresting George W. Bush and Tony Blair for war crimes often comes up, few ever mention John Howard's involvement in the invasion. We probably should do a better job of that. Because, well, were I an Australian, and I'll be quite honest, the idea seems appealing, were I an Australian raising children down there, and John Howard were to come walking down the street, I would make sure that my children spat on the ground before crossing the street to make sure that they did not even come within the same space or breathe the same air as him. Robert continues, current Prime Minister Tony Abbott has reaffirmed Australia will work closely with the United States before deciding what to do about the deteriorating security situation in Iraq. It sounds as though Tony Abbott doesn't really know what to do. He actually has to make a decision which could make him instantly unpopular with most Australians. You know what he can do? He could divert everybody's attention by talking about what a hoax climate change is some more. Oh, dear. Following along behind the U.S. in yet another military adventure that's bound to fail and cost another $5 billion for nothing isn't going to go down well, after the recent austerity budget. Yeah, where are you going to find $5 billion to do it with, Robert? I mean, you're being austere, right? You don't have the money. Funny how after hooting and hollering about the deficit and you know, wanting to put the hurt on Granny and see a little more canned mackerel eating. I say canned mackerel instead of cat food because it was Kate who reminded me a long time back that that was cheaper than cat food. Cat food's getting kind of pricey. All of a sudden their deficit worries are over, and they want to have themselves a nice, tasty little war. You know, I've had blood sausage, and it's not bad. Blutwurst. It's not bad at all. It's downright good. But, you know, the neocons and the PNACers and the whole filthy war crime crowd, they like their blood straight up, no chaser, no sidecar. Well, then, I mean, let's be clear. Dick Cheney likes to sip his through his fangs. Robert concludes, it's all like a truly horrible movie franchise that just won't end. Gulf War, Gulf War II, Iraq invasion, Gulf War III, let's invade again. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of innocent people dying. I'm sick of no end in sight, ever. And see, that's how it's supposed to work. A few minutes ago, I got a tweet in from our buddy Isaac with a fairly simple question that looks like it has a fairly simple answer. I like those answers. The question being, do you think today's events in Iraq is because someone's trying to make sure of a cell? Oh, goodness. Are we going to have to worry about put options again? The United States plans to sell nearly $1 billion worth of warplanes, armored vehicles, and surveillance aerostats to Iraq. The deal includes 24 AT-6C Texan II light attack aircraft, a turboprop plane manufactured by Beechcraft that has 50-caliber machine guns, advanced avionics, and can carry precision-guided bombs, the Pentagon said. The aircraft and related equipment and services are valued at $790 million. A new car! You get a plane! You get a plane! You get a plane! The proposed sale of these aircraft equipment and support will enhance the ability of the Iraqi forces to sustain themselves in their efforts to bring stability to Iraq and to prevent overflow of unrest into neighboring countries. The week's deal also included 200 up-armored Humvee vehicles with machine gun mounts worth $101 million. Iraq has previously agreed to purchase 36 U.S. F-16 fighter jets. The up-armored Humvees will help Iraq's ability to defend its oil infrastructure against terrorist attacks. Oh, will it? This coming from SaharaNet. I'm sorry, NaharaNet. NaharaNet. Well, the business of America is business, isn't it? I still say we should take In God We Trust off the currency and put that on there. Maybe create maybe take Lincoln off the penny, move him to the nickel, leave FDR on the dime, put Jefferson on the quarter, put Washington on a 50-cent piece, and put Calvin Coolidge on the... let's just make a half penny. Put Calvin Coolidge on that. He was Silent Cal, after all. 4 minutes past the hour, and thanks very much to Asa and Beth for meeting the remainder of Darlene's challenge, as well as $5 worth of Dr. John's challenge. It remains on the table. We need $45 more to complete Dr. John's challenge, so that you can double your money. 45 will turn into 90. 20 will turn into 40. You know the drill. You know where the PayPal button is, too. And it's not inspiring to get into a hole this early in the process. And, frankly, we started the evening at $240, and we have now taken it down by 145. So that would be a big help if we could finish meeting Dr. John's challenge. So we are at $95 to go. $95 to go. Meeting Dr. John's challenge will pretty nearly knock it out. So anybody wanting to stand in with Darlene and with Asa and with Beth, you would be in mighty, mighty, mighty good company. We have spent indeed a lot of time this evening, this Moran Monday, on the Moran Tony Blair, and on the overall Moranity of thinking that, if we just apply a little bit more machine gun, we can get ourselves some democracy in Iraq. I liked it a lot better when it was more cowbell instead of more machine gun, or more cowbell instead of more bomb. But there is other stuff out there. Let's take a break. I want to play something for you. It was a few weeks ago that we played the advanced track from the Dye Pritchard Band's Killin' Time album, Superstitious. And the album is out now, and I've had the chance to listen to it, and it is good from top to bottom. There's not a bad track on it. So I thought we would take, in taking a little break, I thought you might like to hear a little bit more, another cut from the album. How about the title track, Killin' Time? The Dye Pritchard Band, featuring, I might add, our very own John Fox on drums, and just an overall really, really solid, tight rock and roll band. Sometimes it's just nice to hear straight ahead rock and roll. It seems to be kind of hard to come by these days. There's plenty of it here. You can get your own copy of Killin' Time, by the way, at DiePritchard.com. That's DaiPritchard, DiePritchard.com. Killin' Time on the horn. We'll be right back.
dead after me now. 10,000 guns, I'm going down. End of the line, my turn to burn, my killing time. I told him once, don't cross the line. He stepped over, now it's killing time. You do not touch that which is mine. No turning back, it's killing time.
God, isn't that cool? Reminds me why I love rock and roll. Just awesome. The Dye Pritchard Band, DaiPritchard.com, DaiPritchard.com, to get your own copy, and you're going to enjoy it, without a doubt. There's lots more on that album. 11 rock-solid tracks, just awesome. And we'll be playing more of it in days to come. I got permission. I might be the only American playing this on the radio right now. Internet or terrestrial. Ah. Yeah, see? By the way, speaking of radio, over the weekend, when Bill mentioned the passing of Chuck Knoll, I thought, before he went toward football, that he was going to note the passing of a guy who was deemed to be pretty much America's DJ. Casey Kasem passed away. 82, was he? And I never knew that he had the liberal street cred that he did. I'd never listened, well, except when I was jocking a million years ago, and would have to play American Top 40 on, say, a Sunday afternoon shift. A lot of downtime there. You could get production work done, things like that. But you know, just really, and it seemed like Air Supply stayed in the rotation forever and just wouldn't go away. It wasn't really like that, but it was bad enough. He was, of course, the iconic voice of Shaggy on Scooby-Doo. And it was said in the obituary write-ups that he was, and this is not a Moran Monday nomination, that he was the first one ever to contractually require that a cartoon character that he voiced be vegetarian. And I guess there's some truth in that, insofar as he insisted he quit doing the voiceover for Shaggy when they asked him to do a Burger King commercial with Shaggy's voice. And he just said, no, I won't. And you know, he's a very, very committed vegetarian. He would be, were he alive, and was probably saddened and disgusted on the way out the door by what we've been talking about, or this bloodthirsty urge of a certain quarter in the American political spectrum to go back and waste some more lives in the sand-filled meat grinder that is Iraq. But I'll tell you truly, you know how I remember Casey Kasem? Truthfully. And not in a bad way either. This clip. Because it's an indication. God, how many American Top 40s did he voice? And it's an indication, a reminder, that this can be a very, very frustrating business. And to sit there day after day, week after week, pitching the same middle-of-the-road dreck. It couldn't have been easy. I can't imagine that Casey Kasem didn't just actually like music that was not middle-of-the-road, adult contemporary, top 40. He just had to. You just had to. But this is one of those moments that was captured in the booth that shows how frustrating it can be to try to do this work. And sometimes I just, oh God, I despise Windows 8. I do. But let's remember Casey Kasem.
Dedication. And this one is about kids and pets and a situation that we can all understand, whether we have kids or pets or neither. It's from a man in Cincinnati, Ohio, and here's what he writes. Dear Casey, this may seem to be a strange dedication request, but I'm quite sincere, and it'll mean a lot if you play it. Recently, there was a death in our family. He was a little dog named Snuggles, but he was most certainly a part of... Let's come start again. From coming out...
Yeah, we're going to... Let's get that take again. So you've got all the setup, right? It can be a very frustrating business. Very frustrating. Which is an emotion we can all agree with, whether we've been a disc jockey or a voiceover artist or neither of the above.
The record. Play the record, okay? Please.
Please. Do you hear the desperation in the please? Okay, play the record. And you know, he's got his cans on. And everybody's working for the weekend. Everybody wants a new romance. Right? Play the record. Please.
See, when you come out of those up-tempo goddamn numbers, man, it's impossible to make those transitions. And then you got to go into somebody dying. You know, they do this to me all the time. I don't know what the hell they do it for. But goddamn it, if we can't come out of a slow record, I don't understand it. Is Don on the phone? Okay, I want a goddamn concerted effort to come out of a record that isn't a fucking up-tempo record every time I do a goddamn death dedication. Now, make it, and I also want to know what happened to the pictures I was supposed to see this week. This is last goddamn time I want somebody to use his fucking brain to not come out of a goddamn record that is that's up-tempo, and I got to talk about a fucking dog dying.
See, I don't hold that against him. Not at all. Because somebody was screwing with him. If you notice time after time after time that you're doing some sort of heartbreaking dedication coming out of an up-tempo record, somebody's messing with you. And it's probably because he was such just a nice guy that they wanted to see how far they could push him before he'd lose it. So... here's hoping, in whatever afterlife there is for you, Casey, here's hoping you've got a producer who doesn't like to just mess with you for the sake of messing with you. Yeesh. 20 minutes past the hour, and no, we have more morons. And it grieves me. It does. It grieves me to share this moron with you. Because it's not a right-wing moron. It's not a libertarian moron. It's not a John Birch moron, a teabagging moron, a murderous former British prime minister moron. It's not a religion industry moron. No, it's a moron from our side. Yeah, I know. Here's the copy from NBC News. Greenpeace... yeah, you know what? This does have some duct tape and hockey puck aspect to it. Greenpeace has suffered a 3.8 million euro, that's $5.2 million, loss on what is described in the news account as an ill-timed bet in the currency market by a well-intentioned, if reckless, employee in its financial unit. You can tell that whoever was writing this news story was kind of grieved by it, too, because they're trying to take the sting out of it right there in the first paragraph. It was a 3.8 million euro loss. in an ill-timed bet. See, it was bad timing. It was well-intentioned, but it was reckless. Or the employee was. The details. The environmental group, which is based in Amsterdam, said Monday the employee, who had bet the euro would not strengthen against other currencies in 2013 when it did. In other words, he bet against the strength of the euro because there's been so much news out there for the past year and a half about all the financial difficulties and how the euro is going to fall apart and blah, 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 blah. So he took $5.2 million and the boys there at the currency market spun the roulette wheel and cried, place your bets, place your bets, place your bets. And then once all the bets were down, red, black, 12, the green double zero, the croupier called, le jeu sans fait, and the little marble descended and went clackety, 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 clack. And where our described as reckless, if ill-intentioned, Greenpeace employee saw that no, the ball did not land in red like he had put the $5.2 million on, but instead had landed in the black. And they took the little rake and they raked the $5.2 million away. And said, I'm very sorry, monsieur. Will you play again? No, he had acted beyond the limits of his authority. He was operating beyond the scope. Greenpeace International fired the employee, whom it did not identify, but said there was no evidence of fraud. Greenpeace spokesman Mike Townsley, in a telephone interview from Mexico, said, every indication is this was done with the best of intentions, but not the best of judgment. Okay. Bad call. Should have bet on black. He said the organization was deeply concerned that the incident would offend its supporters and apologized. Greenpeace, and this sounds a little like the horn, Greenpeace does not accept contributions from companies or governments and is funded entirely by individuals. Responsibility lies partly with the employee and partly with the organization, Townsley said. The employee was a financial expert, well, one wonders how expert, whose job included currency trades to protect the organization from fluctuations in the market. He was not qualified, however, to undertake trades on the scale he did. In addition, he probably had a hot tip. No, Aqueduct, the third. In the third race at Aqueduct. Yeah. Pick me, Nick. Oh, Barney, you gotta let me go. In addition, he ignored company rules under which he should have checked with supervisors and probably hired an external expert for advice on how to manage risks. Probably hired. Ah, hey, come here, buddy. Hey, really, you got $5.2 million laying around? I can double it. No, I can. No, the fee is going to be very small. Greenpeace is right to be worried about this. Because Greenpeace has put them in a position of sitting there in the same stew pot with, say, the Sierra Club, who took millions upon millions upon millions of dollars, as did, what, NRDC? From the fracking industry. And that's why that's in there, too. That's why that line's in there about Greenpeace does not accept contributions from companies or governments and is funded entirely by individuals. No, really, we're not like the Sierra Club and NRDC. We've never taken a nickel from the fracking industry, let alone several tens of millions of dollars. And Greenpeace has a really, really good reputation in terms of the actions that it does and its intentions. But wow, did they screw up here. And it really is obviously a failure of organizational management. One, okay, you've got a pot of money. And when the pot gets big enough, you start worrying about the money. Because among other things, it's that money that allows you to pay campaigners and staffers enough to live and eat on, maybe, and to pay the top echelon of your organization enough to live like princelings and princesslings. And I'll warrant that it probably, there's nobody. Because what we see with Greenpeace is their work with their ships, and they have an action camp where they teach young campaigners how to campaign, climb rocks and climb towers and hang banners and go out in boats and save animals and dodge oil tankers and stuff like that. And you don't think about Greenpeace being a humongously because when you're playing around in the millions of euros, you're pretty well a corporate organization. And yet, I had to get it in there, not out of sense of rubbing it in or anything, but out of a sense of hopefully raising awareness. How can I put this? Great environmental change, since we're talking about environmental groups, is never going to come from the big greens. Now, they can help. They have tremendous war chests, and they have massive megaphones and email lists to die for. I mean, I get Sierra pitches all the time. Save the last gray wolf. Oh. Yeah. And we'll send you a canvas messenger bag just like the one carried by John Muir. Yeah, it's troubling. Troubling indeed. And see, this is why there was a report put out by, what was it? Was it Philanthropy Magazine or something like that? They were commissioned to do a study on why it is that we don't win any environmental battles. This was a couple of years ago. And we don't win any environmental battles because the big greens don't spend the money right. Now, they will ride the backs of grassroots heroes, and they will fundraise off the backs of the grassroots heroes, but very little gets, because the study found that if you really want to create environmental change, what you do is you support the grassroots workers who are getting the job done, often working for free, and sweating the power bill, and sweating the mortgage payment, and wondering whether to buy food that month or new tires. And the report made it pretty clear that the money is not going downhill like it's supposed to. And that, in fact, is why there are no victories. I mentioned that, for instance, by way of pointing out that the 8 campaign, which single-handedly got the first bill introduced in Congress ever that would out-and-out ban mountaintop removal, has never received a penny from the Sierra Club, or for that matter, Greenpeace. See how it works. Now, you know, Sierra has sent out email blasts with pictures of, well, hell, people I know, talking about how we need to end mountaintop removal. And it always ends at the bottom with, can you give the Sierra Club a donation? But it doesn't include, we're not going to send any of that money downhill to the person in the picture there. That's a dancing hillbilly. They're here to dance to get you, right. See? Yeah. No, we have more ands. We have an abundance of more ands. What else? Ooh. Here's a more and. Senator Thad Cochran of Mississippi stand. Now, he is, he's in the battle of his political life with a teabagger by the name of Pappy McDaniel. No, they don't call him Pappy. I'm confusing him with the Charles Durning character from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Because after all, Pappy McDaniel was never the reform candidate, and the reform candidate is McDaniel. Chris McDaniel, teabagger. Chris McDaniel's the one whose supporters broke into the nursing home where Thad Cochran's wife is presently suffering from senile dementia and, I believe, Alzheimer's, to take pictures of her. Stay classy, teabaggers. They also, his supporters, managed to somehow get themselves locked into the county courthouse the night of the Republican primary, June 3rd, in Mississippi stand. They got themselves locked into the courthouse somehow and got left all alone with all those ballots. Mm-hmm. Isn't that terrifying? Ruh-roh, Aggie. Wow. So where does that leave Thad? Thad has to burnish his credibility with the reform teabagger crowd. Now, short of putting on some long underwear with the flap on it made out of a Gadsden flag with the don't read to me snake on the very front on the chest there like the S on a Superman, it's a challenge. Admittedly, but Thad was up for the challenge. The story was in the Jackson Clarion Ledger, and Thad was giving a little talk to a group of donors and political followers and hangers-on and so forth at the Forest General Hospital in Hattiesburg, Mississippi stand. And Thad is not from Hattiesburg or the Hattiesburg area. But when you're a politician, you always want to establish some sort of a connection. You know, hello, Cleveland, right? With wherever it is you're talking. So, enter Thad. I really do wish I had audio of this. I grew up coming down here for Christmas, Thad Cochran said. My father's family was here. My mother's family was from rural Hinds County in Utica. It was fun. It was an adventure to be out there in the country and to see what goes on. Picking up pecans, from that to all kinds of indecent things with animals.
And I know some of you know what that is.
Welcome to America. Welcome to 2014. Jesus Land, Mississippi Stan, how to get elected.
Oh, my opponent says he's the reform candidate. And that he's going to be a better senator than me, but has he ever done indecent things with animals in outside of Hattiesburg, Mississippi? I submit to you, my dear friends, that he has not. And that means he is unsuited. Unsuited, I tell you, to enter the Senate of the United States of America and protect freedom like I protect freedom. Can you trust a man who's never done indecent things with animals to stand up to the EPA and all of their lying about how southern Mississippi going to be underwater one of these days real soon? Can a man who's never done an indecent thing with an animal be trusted to stand up and demand for the 915th time that Obamacare be repealed and make sure that nobody in Mississippi who can go to the doctor when they're sick? Can we trust a man like Pappy McDaniel, knowing full well he, unlike me, has never done an indecent thing with an animal? God bless America and God bless the state of Mississippi, Stan. I'm Thad Cochran, and I approve this message.
Can't make it up. Oh, no. No. Anybody want to take bets? Where else? More ants. More cowbell. If we had a little more time, I could run that song all about how paranoia runs deep. You know, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Yeah, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. But we don't have to, because we've actually got the audio here of Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, Stan, who is finally ready. His conscience can no longer bear it. He is finally ready to tell the world the truth about that one in our White House. Yes, he is a Kenyan Muslim anti-colonialist with deep-seated hatred of white people. Jim Inhofe knows it. And he's got the goods. Really?
So the question is, what can Congress do? And we can control funds, but again, it doesn't, because if we were to put money in there for the purpose of allowing them to start using surveillance and intelligence and maybe giving equipment and all that, there's no assurance that the president couldn't stall it. Mm-hmm. And so that's the, people say, do something. Well, you know, never in my political career, in my memory, did it ever occur to me that we would have a president of the United States who would be doing things to supporting the enemy. And so our system isn't set for Congress to deal with this kind of a situation.
Yeah.
It's public opinion is going to bring it down, as that's only there to think of.
What, no impeachment? This, of course, was a conversation on the Family Research Council's Washington Watch. That would be the Family Research Council of Tony. Yes, Mother Bates. Perkins. This in from Gail. Thad. That's a uniquely American name. Hello, I'm Thad. Well, smile. The sun will come out tomorrow. I think it goes back to when we wrote words like in Congress. But Jim Inhofe, oh my God. I guess you just get to go on Washington Watch of the Family Research Council, take the brown acid, and just wait for the bats to fly.
They are doing things that militarily are just stupid in trying, and all these hearings, by the way, that they have, these classified briefings that we had, like the one we had this morning, I almost don't mind talking about what they said because it's all so orchestrated. They always have five or six people from the administration, all of them agreeing with the president. And, just like the thing that they went through in turning the terrorists loose, you might remember that started in the Rose Garden when Obama, claiming full control and ownership of that trade, thought he'd be a real hero in bringing this one American home until people realized that he turned loose the most vicious, heinous terrorists to go back to the fight with no security in terms of where they're going to go. Just taking the word for a bunch of people in Qatar that now, and then all of a sudden after he had total control of that and it didn't turn out, now it's Chuck Hagel's fault. And of course he testified, you know, this is his recommendation, to the president. So that's what we're watching now is just all that cover. But these are things that are costing today American lives, Tony. This is not just an insignificant thing.
Isn't it interesting how he's concerned about costing American lives, and yet he didn't have any problem costing 4,000 or 5,000 American lives back when Dim Leader wanted to invade Iraq and wage war on the people of Iraq, and is conservatively estimated to have caused something in excess of 1 million excess deaths. I don't know. Maybe Jim Inhofe could leak classified information to prove that one is collaborating with the Terrorists and supporting the enemy. Wow.
You know, Senator, we've been talking about this a lot lately, especially with the Bergdahl swap, and I'm going to ask you about that in a moment. But, you know, and people now are calling in on a regular basis and saying, you know, I knew this administration was incompetent, but I believe this goes beyond incompetence. I believe some of it's intentional. They're working working intentionally to undermine America, or they simply have no clue whatsoever.
And, you know, if I were to agree with that, I'd lose all credibility in going on, and because that'd be the first thing they'd accuse me of. But I have to tell you, those people have every reason to believe what they're believing now. This couldn't just keep happening over and over again.
No, it couldn't. The voices in my head couldn't keep telling me that he's a Kenyan Muslim anti-colonialist with a deep-seated hatred of white people. Over and over again. It can be a chore, these Moran Mondays. By the way, a little news broke over the weekend. You remember when the 15-year-old took his parents' freedom protectors to school with him? Probably do. He killed one person, wounded another, and then killed himself. Because freedom. Wolverines! Yeah. Well, we know now a little bit about why he did what he did. He left a diary. Dear diary. Jared Padgett left a diary saying that it was his purpose in life to kill, and this is a quote from his diary, sinners. Yeah. Sinners. apparently the sinner that he did manage to kill was Emilio Hoffman. And police found out about this because they searched his father's home after Jared Padgett went off to wherever he was planning on going that didn't have any sinners in it. Naturally, when asked about the boy, people said things like, I just can't believe it. He was very quiet, very serious about his church. That's Earl Milliron. No, really, can't make these names up. Earl Milliron needed people to understand that Jared Padgett was having trouble with his mom and dad's divorce. It was rather tragic, the breaking up of the family, and that took a heavy toll on his dad. His father, Michael Padgett, issued a statement saying, "Our family does not condone and has never promoted violence or hatred toward anyone. The values we have taught our children are love in Jesus Christ, compassion, forgiveness, and patience." Didn't take. Yeah. He was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Gresham, Oregon. Church elders said that he was highly regarded for his spirituality. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Gresham, Oregon said, "With the entire community, we are shaken and profoundly troubled by this tragedy that has impacted the lives of so many families and individuals. We are praying for all those involved, oh good, and hope they will be given the peace they need during this difficult time." By whom? So there we have it. Parent with a stash of deadly firearms makes sure that his child is absolutely immersed in religious poppycock that includes lingo like sinners, who, you might recall from early American history, are in the hands of an angry God. And you mix the two, and, wow, Emilio Hoffman pays the price. Back to Jim Inhofe, a note coming in from Ron and Raleigh. "Dear Lord, these people really, really hate that Negro in their White House, don't they?" Yes, they do. That's why all those lives that were sacrificed in Iraq are about to be rendered in vain, because we're not going to send some more of America's young people to go and die in vain with the other ones, and that way it won't be in vain, and it'll be for freedom. Ron and Raleigh also noting, Bob, Bob, Bob. You know, the emails that begin Bob, Bob, Bob never end well. I'm kidding. Bob, Bob, Bob. You know that this is another anti-Christian false flag operation by the Obama regime. Yes, absolutely. Glad you brought it up. We wouldn't be serious about Morans if we didn't have something from the Moran in chief. And this isn't just the Moran in chief. This is sort of a Moran tete-a-tete. This is not just Alex Jones, but Alex Jones and Larry Pratt of Gun Goobers of America. Duct tape, hockey puck. Fair warning.
Shifting gears into other issues, the Washington Times last week got an Army document by concerned people, and it openly said, and this has officially been confirmed, that they're training with tanks, armored vehicles, drones under an Obama directive 2012 to take on the American people, namely the Tea Party. Forbes also reported on that. So the billions of bullets, the Homeland Security saying the Tea Party's the threat, I mean, this is crazy. What is Obama thinking?
Well, he's certainly not thinking that Muslims are a threat. So he's turning to his political opponents, declaring that they're the enemy, and ignoring the fact that Muslims from time to time have a tendency to go boom. And it is really shows how upside down, mixed up.
Time out. Okay, Jack, time out. Ignoring the fact that Muslims occasionally have a tendency to go boom. Jared Padgett was a Muslim? What's his face in Aurora, Colorado was a Muslim? Adam Lanza in Newtown was a Muslim? Dude in Tucson was a Muslim? Dude in Santa Barbara was a Muslim? Because they apparently have had a tendency to occasionally go boom.
They are, but we shouldn't be surprised, because some time ago, Homeland Insecurity Chief
get the blowgun and the Thorazine dart ready, would you please? He'll never feel it.
Janet Napolitano fingered veterans as potential terrorists, people who believe in the Second Amendment, that are pro-life, that want to work for limited government. I guess that the idea of limited government really would terrorize a socialist. So maybe
because we all know Barack Obama's a socialist. I mean, you got to keep up with the dog whistling here.
We look at it from her point of view.
Yeah, to them, it's terrorism. I mean, George Washington, freedom.
What's he speaking, Norblap?
They're scared of it.
I think that's exactly right. I know it sounds preposterous probably to people listening to this show, except for the few that might be monitoring for the government. But the fact of the matter is, I do think they tend to think that way. The enemy is freedom, and they really are doing what they can to extinguish it. This is a very dangerous administration.
Very dangerous. And the military is going to attack the teabaggers. Uh-huh. Yep. All of them with their signs on the backs of their cars saying Obama is the Antichrist. Yeah. It's going to take an army to take them down. Jesus, you could take down the teabaggers just by exchanging their Velcro strap shoes for ones with shoelaces. Come on, who are we kidding? And just by way, because we're fresh out of time, just by way of warning, one, don't drink and drive. Two, even if you're the sober one and you are driving, be alert to drunks in your car. Story comes out of northern northern Taliban, Indiana. How's that? 24-year-old Amanda Ezra was apparently not feeling any too well when she was sitting on someone's lap in the front passenger seat of an automobile about 4:40 a.m. Sunday yesterday. One, no lap sitting. No lap sitting. And she began to not feel so good, and she stuck her head out the window to have a good purging. And as she got sick, she got dead. Because she whacked her head on something as the car was moving. The horror, 24-year-old woman was a mother of three. St. Joseph County Crash Team Coordinator Tim Spencer said the driver of the minivan and another passenger fled, but police later caught them. The driver, a man in his 20s, was arrested and charged preliminarily with leaving the scene and driving while intoxicated, causing serious bodily injury. You know, I think if he'd been stone cold sober, it's probably still not a good idea to hang your head out the window and puke. And I say that because I'm a paranoid parent. You know how it is with kids. And I don't know why it is this way with kids. I was this way when I was a kid. The window goes down, and you want to make arm dolphins, and just feel the lift of the wind under you. And of course, all of you've done it too. Don't kid me. Get your arm in. Get your arm inside the car. No, really, I will pull this car over. Well, there's a reason for those warnings, and that's it. So it's time to get out of here. Fresh out of time now. Thank you to Darlene for taking care of the challenge she put forward. Thank you to Asa. Thank you to... Thank you to Beth for standing shoulder to shoulder to help with fundraising this evening. We find ourselves closing the program having met the remainder of Darlene's challenge and with Dr. John's challenge still on the table. The next $45 that come in get doubled by Dr. John. It really is a great way to keep all of this going, and thanks to Dr. John and thanks to Darlene for the challenges. Thank you very much. Hopefully the challenge will be taken up in fairly short order. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to Gene and Susan, our news ninjas. Thank you to John Fox, rock and roll drummer. That goes on the resume now, along with helping keeping me sane with all the technology here. Thank you, John Fox, as well as keeping me sane with regard to the website, too. Thanks. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT.org, ACHECT.org. Thank you to all of you who reach out to your elected representatives to either advance the AIC Act, which has already been introduced in the House, or who are reaching out to your senators now to try to get the bill introduced in the Senate before this Congress can close. Thank you very much. It proves that this is more than a radio network. This really is a community. And this is a community that really wants to make things better for people that you may never even know, never meet, never see, that recognize the common bonds of humanity itself. Thank you. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.